The next appeal before the court is Justin and Kim Hammer versus Paul Duffy and Cornerstone Port Foundations, case number 30776. Plaintiffs and appellants are present, represented through counsel Scott Hoy and Danny Ellis. James Hoy is also present. I understand, Mr. Ellis, you'll have the 15-minute opening.
That's correct, Your Honor.
And then Mr. Scott Hoy, you'll do the 5-minute rebuttal.
Yes, Your Honor.
And then Mr. Arndt is present on behalf of defendant appellees. You don't have anybody else with you, so I assume you're doing the whole thing. All right. With that, then, Mr. Ellis, you can proceed.
Good morning, Mr. Chief Justice, Associate Justice, Justices, Honorable Counsel. May it please the Court. The specific issue that brings us here in front of the Supreme Court are there three issues. Number one, whether the trial court erred in excluding the plaintiff's federal motor carrier safety regulations expert, Adam Grill, and expert crash reconstructionist, Mike Detallo. The second issue before this court, whether the trial court erred by refusing to allow plaintiffs to amend their complaint to include direct negligence actions against defendant Cornerstones that is represented by violations of their duties found under the Federal Motor Carrier Safety Regulations. And issue number three, whether the trial court erred by refusing to instruct the jury regarding a violation of Federal Motor Carrier Safety Regulation 49 CFR 392.3. Unless Your Honors would like a brief recitation of the facts, I'd like to jump right into the argument.
Go ahead.
Going with issue number one, whether the trial court erred in excluding the plaintiff's experts in this case. Your Honors, this case or this issue is viewed under an abuse of discretion standard. What is significant about this issue, Your Honors, is we are not quibbling or quibbling over whether Mr. Grill or Mr. Detallo were qualified. We're not, what is not an issue is whether we properly and timely submitted their opinions to defense. What's being argued is whether they provided assistance to the trier of fact. As Kluttman versus Sioux Falls Storm states, it's what is relevant and helpful. Would it assist the trier of fact to understand the evidence or determine a fact and issue? Your Honor, the trial court judge, we believe, and the record indicates, used the wrong standard. The trial judge stated in the court's record at 197, I don't believe the jury needs that kind of expert testimony to help them resolve this matter. Again, at the November 1st, 2022 hearing, I do agree with Mr. Arndt that there still isn't a need to have the expert witness. Your Honors, this is as much as my learned friend would like to pose this as a simple car wreck case. What we have is a complex intersection that has 8 traffic lights that for some reason have become flashing red lights involving a commercial motor vehicle and a regular motor automobile.
So, Mr. Ellis, as it relates to Mr. Grill and his testimony, do you have to prevail on the motion to amend the complaint to prevail on that issue?
I don't believe so, Your Honor, for two reasons. Number one, Mr. Duffy is driving a commercial motor vehicle, and Cornerstone is still being held accountable through the action of respondeat superior. The jury is instructed to weigh negligence, placing themselves in the role or in the shoes of a reasonably prudent person. In this case, a commercial motor vehicle license holder, a Class A license holder. As our South Dakota Commercial Driver's License Manual states, in 4 different sections in the Commercial Driver's License Manual, a commercial motor vehicle operator is a professional driver. I would agree with my friend that if there is a professional responsibility or duty, as is seen in the Hansen case, you need an expert witness. Judge Schroeder agreed. I'm sorry, Your Honor.
No, Mr. Ellis, yeah, if I could. And I'd hate to disrupt that. Your answer and get back to that by all means. But if you hit this out of the park and Mr. Grill testifies and Mr. Detallo testifies, In light of what the jury did, how is Mr. Duffy any more negligent than they already found him to be?
That is a great question, Your Honor. And jurors in South Dakota are instructed to weigh comparative fault when reaching whether a plaintiff's contributory negligence is more than slight. It's not a measure of more negligent. What's being done or what's being forced upon the jury by excluding this evidence is the Indian proverb of six blind men walking up to an elephant and asked to describe the elephant.
So it's relative comparative negligence. He's as negligent as he's going to be, but relative to Mr. Hamer, that could matter. Okay, can I?
Yes, sir.
Because I thought that might be the answer, and I'm glad you brought it up. I would sort of understand that argument a little bit more, perhaps, if there would have been a tort concept of liability like last clear chance that was available for the jury. And Mr. Hoy proposed an instruction like that, and it was denied, and that's not in front of us. So in the last clear chance doctrine, right here, Mr. Duffy would be negligent, Mr. Hamer would see and would himself not act in conformity with the standard, but if Mr. Duffy had enough time to avoid it, then liability would remain with him. That really wasn't what the jury had. And this is what it seems to me like this case boils down to, and it's instruction 21, which is the flashing red light. This is sort of a weird deal. It's not controlled by the normal traffic signals that would apply under general circumstances at this intersection, as I understand it. Flashing red light turns into a four-way stop. The only theory of liability for either party is who has the right of way. I don't see, and this is my ultimate question, what is the factual theory? And I know it's not your claim, you're defending against contributory fault. What is the factual allegation of contributory fault? It seems like it's an alternative allegation of fault, but I don't know what we're comparing.
Well, and that's a good question, Your Honor. What I would say, what you're comparing is what is the actions required of a commercial driver's license holder under South Dakota law that incorporates the Federal Motor Carrier Safety Regulations, the training that goes into behind it, versus what a normal, everyday, unlearned, regular Class D license holder has. The jury is asked to compare the duty and actions of our client, a Class D holder, compared to what was required under the Class A. And under the Class A, Your Honor, a commercial driver's license holder, as Adam Grill would testify, with the different levels of training required, is supposed to not make that turn, is first supposed to look 10 to 12 seconds down the road to see what's there, understand the weight of his vehicle, how long it's going to take him, and let's be very clear, this is a 33,000 gross motor vehicle rated vehicle that doesn't drive like a car, doesn't stop like a car, does not accelerate like a car. He needs to have the training and the mechanism and the method to go, I see this car coming. This is not your typical stop section. And I would argue that it's really not an intersection, Your Honor, because we got, and that's where Mike Dettallo comes in. You've got 10 seconds of acceleration. You've got however many feet, none of which were allowed to come in. And the jury has to go, okay, now, he has all these duties that he's supposed to be looking out for along with the training that's required to do this compared to what a normal person would do.
So let me ask it this way, if I could.
Go ahead.
So if Mr. Duffy has the right of way, he can still lose under your theory?
Yes, Your Honor, because what's required of a commercial driver's license holder is not to take the right-of-way or not to force themselves on the right-of-way. In fact, in the commercial driver's license manual, it says that it's to be given, not taken. So if he's driving down the road and sees our client, which the testimony is, he says, I didn't see him until the last second. As Mr. Dettallo said, he was situationally inattentive. He doesn't see him to the last second. That's where the jury failed to have the information necessary to compare the different duties between the people. So he didn't even see him, Your Honor, so I don't think we could even get there, Your Honor.
Where does Grill come in? You've explained where Dettallo comes in.
Well, so for Mr. Grill, he would come in and explain what is required under the Smith system, for proper scanning techniques of a driver. He would come in under what was required for stopping distance to know, hey, if I start this process, it's going to take me so many seconds to get through the intersection. Oh, and also, if I have to stop because I have air brakes, I'm going to need this extra amount of distance. He would also, Your Honor, which was probably critical, would have talked about the sleep part of the issue. Mr. Duffy testified that he gets broken sleep. He works two jobs. He goes to bed at 8:30 and 11, gets up, delivers papers for 2 hours, and then goes back to sleep and gets up at 6:30. That broken pattern of sleep is in contradiction specifically with 392.3 of the Federal Motor Carrier Safety Regulations, but even under the South Dakota Driver's License Manual, it says that a person is three times more likely. And the critical issue there, Your Honor, is that the owner, Mr. Keith Van Velduza, I butchered his name, I just had to call him Mr. Keith, he said, we disregard the sleep rules. We knew he was not doing this. We just didn't care. That's a paraphrase on my part, probably a little harsh. He said that the rules are the same for trucks and for cars, which then placed in the jurors' minds a lower duty, which Adam Grohl could have corrected. He said that everyone is different when it comes to sleep and what they need. Well, the rules are very clear on what's required of commercial motor vehicle holders. Adam Grohl could have addressed that as well. And then the only difference you got to do between a car and a truck is you got to understand your truck. And that's not the case.
But that gets back to Justice Salter's question about the direct claim against Cornerstone for negligent supervision or negligent training or whatever it might be. How is that compared to the plaintiff's negligence?
Well, two things, Your Honor. So first, if we would have been able to present our direct negligence claims, every situation is not just a driver and his negligence. There's something that causes that driver to do that. If you just only proceed on respondent superior claim, then the idea is that every driver in all of South Dakota is properly and 100% trained, and that's not the case. A jury needs to look at what a company did beforehand to place that driver in the situation where he was negligent in addition. Now, our case before this court, we didn't get to do that. So our argument would be that the jury didn't get the whole picture, that a major piece of the picture of the pie was missing when it came to comparative fault analysis. But for respondeat superior, both the driver and the commercial motor carrier are charged with complying with these Federal Motor Carrier Safety Regulations. Back to your point, Your Honor, that's why Adam Grohl not testifying is a huge hole for this jury to make that determination. Back to your question, Chief Justice, then why would it make a difference? Well, it would make a difference because that driver is charged with knowing all those things, and we could have presented that evidence saying this is what you should have known, this is what you should have done it, these are the things that you're required to do, especially with the sleep, and that was all left unrebutted. And in fact,
some of that did come in to trial anyway through the commercial motor vehicle or the commercial driver's manual, and you know, you were able to develop that through some similar provisions and concessions as that applies.
So I
guess this would go more to the prejudice question. If we were to find the court abused its discretion, we would still have, in keeping that out, we would still have to make a determination how that ultimately prejudiced you from making the arguments and asserting those claims.
Well, Your Honor, I would say, yes, we've got to develop some of the evidence. However, that evidence was our knees were cut out when the owner got to take the stand without any rebuttal against him because we couldn't bring the authority figure, so to speak, and have them say, no, that's not true. It's almost like we were Magellan. Magellan is credited with circumventing the globe, but he actually died in the Philippines. And it was the first mate that got all the way around. We just got to the Philippines. We didn't make it all the way around. We didn't get to get home because we didn't have the ability to refute what was wrong testimony in the record. And that would be the prejudice, because now the jury is weighing our conduct versus the conduct of Mr. Duffy, where his owner and boss is saying, oh, we don't really have to do that. Mr. Ellis and Mr. Hoyer making a big deal about nothing.
So your argument is that there is a regulatory duty, statutory duty, by virtue of our enactment of these regulations. There's a legal duty, not a common law duty, for Mr. Duffy to avoid the accident, even though he may have had, under the rules of the road, the right-of-way.
What I would say, Your Honor, is under the enactment of the South Dakota law, enacting the Federal Motor Carrier Safety Regulations, he has a duty to operate the tractor-trailer or the commercial motor vehicle. It wasn't a tractor-trailer. It was a flat truck. Yeah. In a commercially reasonable manner, as other similarly situated drivers would do, and the jury was left without the proper foundation to help make that determination.
I'm not sure that's an answer, though.
Well,
so could he can he lose? Can he still lose and be held liable for negligent for not avoiding, or excuse me, for not avoiding the accident, even if he had the right of it? I don't know whether he did or not, but I mean just theoretically.
Well, Your Honor, I'm out of time. Chief Justice, may I answer the question? What I would say is that's where Mr. Detallo would come in, would help us to actually determine who had the right of way. Or what should have taken place. And I think this case is more than just a right-of-way case. It is once you're driving down the road and you establish your lanes and all that kind of stuff, and you're supposed to be looking as a commercial motor vehicle carrier, as charged by South Dakota statute, is he complying with what's required under 392, how to operate? Is he following under 395 about fatigue, even though he doesn't have to keep hours? 392 says he can't drive it, he's too fatigued. And I would say, yes, Your Honors, that's part of the reason why he didn't see our client, is he was too fatigued, and that record was left vacant. Your Honors, I would ask that this jury verdict be vacated, the trial court rulings be reversed, and the case be remanded. If there are any further questions, thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you. Stern, you may proceed.
Thank you. May it please the court and counsel, Mark Arndt on behalf of the appellees and defendants in this case. I'm going to start with maybe a little bit of an audible based upon the questions I heard from the court and some of the arguments just made by appellant's counsel. I want to start with issue number two, as framed in appellant's brief regarding the amended complaint issue, because I think at least Justice Salter and perhaps others asked a key question about whether or not some of these expert witness opinions are still relevant or would be an argument that the appellants would maintain if the original complaint were allowed to be amended. And I think the short answer to that question is absolutely not. I mean, if the court is considering all of the other issues raised in this case, let's start with the original complaint in which this case was tried upon. It was a 10-paragraph complaint. It's in the record. It's in the certified record. And it was a very straightforward negligence claim. It did not allege Federal Motor Carrier Safety Regulation violations. It did not allege CDL violations. It was a straightforward traffic negligence claim. It wasn't until 2 weeks prior to our trial date that the truck wreck justice firm came in and assisted plaintiff's counsel by proposing a new amended complaint. 2 weeks prior to trial, we had already had a scheduling order in which the discovery deadline had expired a full year prior. We had two jury trials set that were continued.
Of course, it was before the matter was argued. The trial then was continued, it appears, because of a conflict the court had set it for about 8 months down the road.
Absolutely.
So, I understand your argument about these were totally whole new theories, different direction, but at least with regard to the issue of how it would prejudice your client to prepare to defend that, why wouldn't that have been sufficient time to allow you to do that?
Well, we would have had to restart discovery. I mean, the plaintiff's theories were completely changing.
So let me ask you this, and it's probably not in the record, so it may not be a fair question, but the discovery that had been conducted, answers to interrogatories, depositions, things like that, have there been discussions about the federal motor carrier laws and regulations? I mean, when this motion was filed, was it the first time it ever been mentioned in the case?
The first time the plaintiffs proposed their amended complaint was the first time any discussions about federal motor carrier safety rules or CDL violations or anything of that sort had been raised.
Well, but that was Grill's report that was full of discussion about that they disclosed to you several months, maybe over a year, before they moved to amend the complaint.
And I'm not prepared to answer the question specifically as to when we received Mr. Grill's report. Fair enough. If the record reflects that we received it before the plaintiffs filed their amended complaint, then I guess that's what the record would reflect.
Had you taken Grill's depo?
No. Would I have? Or did?
Did you?
No. No. The court, in our opinion, the circuit court, properly denied plaintiff's amended complaint, which, again, was purported to grow from 10 paragraphs to 36 paragraphs and make all kinds of new allegations, including these negligent supervision, negligent hiring, negligent training, none of which were a part of the original complaint.
So the court appears to have denied the motion to amend both on timeless grounds, prejudice, and also that it was futile, that those claims didn't exist in South Dakota. Does that matter?
Yeah, I think it does. And
Let's say the court was wrong about futility. Does that matter?
Yes, for sure. I think it does, because there's still prejudice that the court would have to weigh under these circumstances. We raised the Rise opinion.
It could have been weighed differently had the court just been looking at straight prejudice and timeliness versus, well, this isn't a valid claim anyway, so I'm just kicking it.
Yeah, hard for me to get into the circuit court's head on that issue, but I would argue that the amended complaint was denied for both reasons, and both reasons were proper. There was prejudice as well as futility. I mean, if the court, I think the court is clear, the statute's clear, 15.6.15a, and that amendments to pleading should be liberally allowed. But as this court has stated, and again, we cite in the Rise opinion, the 2022 opinion of this court, the most important consideration in determining whether a party should be allowed to amend a pleading is whether the non-moving party will be prejudiced by the amendment.
But again, that prejudice analysis changes quite a bit. If you don't have a valid claim, there's kind of more prejudice versus there isn't. And I understand prejudice is assessing yours, but that does matter.
Prejudice is often shown when a party is surprised and unprepared to meet the contents of the proposed amendment. 2 weeks prior to trial is when this amended complaint motion was brought. That's too late to change the rules of what we've been litigating for the past 3 or 4 years. It's just too late. I mean, the idea that we would totally change course regarding plaintiffs' new theories at that stage in the game, if that is not prejudice, it's hard for me to understand what prejudice would be.
Can you just talk a bit about the futility basis? So there appears to be no dispute from opposing counsel that there's no private right of action with regard to these federal motor safety carrier regulations. However, what they seem to be arguing, however, is that they have been enacted by statute, the ones relevant here. Why can't those, like any other traffic safety type statute, still form the basis of the negligence per se? So that's a different scenario than what we had in Highmark and the particular type of federal law that was being addressed there.
I think Highmark can be distinguished slightly, but the precedent of Highmark certainly applies. And I think this is the most important issue in this case. As a matter of public policy, my request would be that the court would specifically address this issue and rule on this issue if the court is able to do so. Because there are now significant pieces of litigation throughout this state that are being based upon private causes of action, individual causes of action for personal injury plaintiffs based upon the federal motor carrier safety regulations. and I believe it's absolutely incorrect.
Well, if prejudice is right, then why would we address, why wouldn't we even need to address that issue?
I understand the court can decide to not address this issue depending upon its rulings on issues one and two. I believe the litigants of this state, the parties of this state, would benefit from the court addressing this issue sooner rather than later. And I believe it's right.
Do you see a difference between the argument that a legal standard is being used, drawn from a statute which enacts regulations, that's being used as the standard for a negligence per se claim versus what we might call a private right of action? Do you see them as being different?
I don't. I think it's the exact same thing.
Maybe. The negligence per se thing, I thought for sure, you would have to have causation, right? You would have, a negligence per se claim is a negligence claim. You just have a standard that isn't the reasonable person standard. It's set out there.
Sure.
I wondered if a private right of action was something different.
Well, causation is always going to be an element, for sure. So I appreciate the court's perspective on that topic. But let's look at this. Let's try to put it in the context of as specific as we can and what's ripe in this case. The plaintiff's specific proposed jury instruction on the Federal Motor Carrier Safety Regulations is attachment J to the appellant's appendix. The final paragraph of that pattern jury instruction, after the jury instruction proposes to set forth a number of specific Federal Motor Carrier Safety Regulation statutes, plaintiffs propose in the final paragraph that the jury consider that if these federal regulations, or it actually states, these federal regulations set the standard of care of a reasonable motor carrier and commercial vehicle driver. If you find that one or both of the defendants violated these regulations, such a violation is negligence. They are seeking a cause of action under the Federal Motor Carrier Safety Regulations. If that's not a cause of action, I'm not sure how you would get to what is a cause of action. They're claiming if you violate these statutes, you violated the law, and the defendants are negligent.
Doesn't that kind of cut against your argument on the motion to amend? Because if we were just talking about law and legal theories, that's one thing in terms of, well, this is a statute that's negligence per se, or this is the rule. But if it's correct that there is no separate cause of action, I know you're arguing there is, but if there isn't, then those are just legal claims. You don't have any facts to develop on that, do you?
If I understand the justice's question, I'm going to go back to the beginning of that question. I don't think it does cut against our argument because we believe these Federal Motor Carrier Safety Regulations, there are no authority that it creates a personal injury cause of action. And therefore, their amended complaint was futile. It was both futile, but it was also prejudicial to us because it was brought so late in the game. And I'm not sure if that addressed the question or if there's another one. Yes, they would have to develop facts to support violations of these regulations. But the circuit court properly ruled that, A, it was too late in the game to bring those up, and secondly, it was futile because these regulations don't create a private cause of action. But I think the court should be clear, and the appellants candidly acknowledge, there is plenty of federal district court case law interpreting the Federal Motor Carrier Safety Regulation statutes in which all or at least a huge majority of those courts conclude personal injury causes of action are not created by these rules. The fact that the South Dakota legislature adopted a portion of these rules doesn't create more rights, doesn't create a personal injury cause of action for the plaintiffs. It just adopts the statutes as they are.
So a number of courts have looked at those and determined that they can provide the standard of care for a common law negligence claim.
Yeah.
Including Levine, one of our federal district courts. And other state courts have found the same. In Highmark cited the Hoffmeister, I think the name of it, case that referred to how it's a matter of state law, whether or not you know, a federal regulation here. The state has adopted it into our state code, can constitute or can still be relied upon for the standard of care. So there does appear to be, and maybe there's a split in authority of that. We haven't specifically addressed that with regard to these particular regulations, but please address that.
I will. Thank you, Justice Devaney. Our position on that is that the standard of care with one of these statutes is the same thing as alleging a cause of action. If you're instructing the jury that this is a statute and a violation of the statute is negligence, that's a cause of action.
But how is it different from the other traffic safety statutes, traffic laws? Because the instructions that were given to the jury with regard to the right-of-way, for example, have the same say the same thing.
Yeah.
So how is it different?
It's different because this particular statute, this federal legislation, specifically doesn't create a cause of action for a personal injury plaintiff. There's a purpose to these federal motor carrier regulations. And one of the, we cited it on page 19 of our brief. I can't state it any better than the Kansas District Court did in a 2016 opinion when it stated, Congress did intend to create private rights of action via the federal motor carrier safety regulations, but not a right of action for personal injury. Instead, Judge Van Bieber reasoned that the statute creates a private cause of action for damages in commercial disputes, but not for personal injury actions. That's the federal district court's interpretation, and that is the majority of the federal district court's interpretations who have ruled on this.
Was it a case where the state had adopted the statute? Because I know some of those were states that had not.
I can't answer that. I was not able to find that. Of course, most of the decisions ruling on this issue do come from the federal district courts because it's federal law. So they have the jurisdiction in those cases. But what I can say is I think it would be quite a leap to conclude that a piece of federal legislation in which the federal justice system has decided doesn't create a specific cause of action for a class of people. For South Dakota, the South Dakota legislature to adopt that legislation shouldn't automatically create a new private or personal injury cause of action. It doesn't grant more rights to a personal injury plaintiff. It adopts the same standard. And if we all agree that it doesn't create a personal injury cause of action standard, then it can't be converted to that just because it's sued out in state court.
Mr. Arndt, I think Justice Salter has one more question for you before you wrap up.
Mr. Arndt, I wanted to clear this up, and I talked with Mr. Ellis about it, and so I want to get your perspective on this. Your claim, it's your claim, not his, and so it's maybe more fair to ask you, what negligence of Mr. Hammer was being compared? And I'll get right to my point. To me, it seems like as it was submitted, and leaving some of these other theories off to the side for just a moment, as the case was submitted, it was Instruction 21, and it was the right-of-way. And so those seem like alternative theories of liability. Either one party had the right-of-way or they didn't. And as instructed, that would really control the outcome of the case. What was being compared?
Yeah, I think which party had the right-of-way, which party was paying attention enough to know at this intersection which vehicle arrived first at a flashing
and
red
yet
light.
The jury finds both parties negligent.
Okay. Yeah, although, and based upon, I think a jury can do that. I think the decision can be reconciled because in South Dakota, the contributory negligence of the plaintiff, if it's greater than slight, is a bar to any recovery.
Actually, what would your theory be that she was contributory, or excuse me, he, Mr. Hammer, was contributorily negligent?
Yes.
What? What is it? So he didn't yield the right of way? Should have yielded the right of way?
Yeah, or didn't arrive at the intersection first. I mean, recall at least the circumstantial evidence in this case indicates that the collision, although close to the middle of the intersection, was closer to Mr. Hammer's point of leaving the intersection versus a commercial truck, which I think it was conceded, would probably be moving slower than the pedestrian vehicle.
And I know it's hard to divine this general verdict form. I don't mean to go down that too far because I know no one really knows. But it seems like if that were the case, that would be a defense verdict. It wouldn't be both parties negligent and one more than slight. Yeah, so,
And fair enough. I mean, we argued for that. I wish the jury would have ruled that way. But instead, the jury ruled that although Mr. Duffy was negligent, Mr. Hammer was also negligent, and his negligence contributed to the accident more than slight.
So, but to wrap it up then, your theory of contributory negligence was the theory of alternate negligence. Hammer was negligent at the right-of-way, not in any other way.
Yeah, Judge. I think that ultimately was our theory of the case, and what I think if you looked at the closing arguments, what we argued to the jury.
Yeah, I did. Yeah, gotcha. Thank you.
There's no accident reconstruction done on this case.
That's correct.
And, I mean, how can you argue that with an eight-lane intersection with multiple on and off ramps, with blinking red lights from every one of the lights simultaneously, that expert testimony would not have aided the jury in analyzing these issues?
If the facts of the accident were different, perhaps expertise would be needed, but they weren't. I mean, the jury heard the testimony of both drivers, the law enforcement officer who investigated the accident, and at the end of the day, as I think everybody agrees, and as was stated by one of the justices' questions, this was converted into a four-way stop. There were flashing red lights. Every lay person who's driven a vehicle at some point is going to approach a four-way stop and understand it. They do not have the right-of-way until it's their turn to proceed. That was the ultimate issue in this case. An expert who didn't witness the accident, who couldn't give any physical information about the vehicles at the accident, would not have been able to assist. And if there's ongoing questions about that, I would say the appellants had an opportunity to present an offer of proof to the circuit court, which the circuit court properly allowed, as to what those experts would say. And those experts' opinions were extremely basic. I mean, Mr. Grill's opinions failed to maintain a proper visual search, failed to properly manage speed and space, failed to recognize hazards in front of them.
Well, DeTallo's was much different, though. He applied calculations, the measurements that he could, being no accident reconstruction, and actually gave an opinion about the number of seconds that your client would have had. And you made arguments to the jury about that in closing. On the same topic that you're saying that the expert witness should not have been allowed to testify on.
Well,
so how do you reconcile that?
My argument to the jury on the issue of negligence was who arrived at the accident scene first, and that the circumstantial evidence would indicate that the Cornerstone driver, Mr. Duffy, was arrived at the accident first.
So they can rely on circumstantial evidence, but not an expert reconstructionist opinion.
I mean, the only thing in my view, so to the justice's question regarding Mr. DeTallo's proposed opinions, situational inattentiveness, I mean, that's probably as broad as you can get to describe anybody involved in an accident, failed to yield to an approaching vehicle, and failed the left turn statute, traffic statute. None of those items require expertise or issues that are scientific, technical, and specialized that would help a fact finder. As to the amount of seconds of perception and reaction time, this wasn't some detailed calculation. This was an accident reconstructionist just guessing at what one of the drivers would have seen or not see. And by the way, although it's not in front of the court and we didn't challenge on qualification of the expert, that would probably require a human factors expert, which Mr. DeTallo is not. He's an accident reconstructionist who's just guessing at one of the vehicle's perception reaction time. There wouldn't be sufficient foundation to even get that issue to the jury. But at the end of the day, our position was, as the circuit court concluded, that these were not issues. The issues of who arrived at the intersection first and therefore had the right of way.
Mr. Arnn, I think you've answered the question.
Thank you.
Mr. Hoy, you may proceed.
Thank you. May it please the court, counsel. I need 90 seconds to set the record straight because I disagree with how this has been characterized. Our experts were delivered during the course of normal discovery with the first complaint. That at that point, seeing respondeat superior and other things that the employer is responsible for negligence of the driver. Those expert reports had everything that was talked about in, and Grill's report had all the federal motor carriers stuff. Then, within the statute of limitations, and before we amended the complaint or attempted to, then Mr. Arndt goes to the court, says, "Well, this is a simple intersection. We really don't need this." Despite my arguments to the contrary, the court then orders, "Well, we're not going to bring those experts in, not because they're Daubert challenged or anything like that, but it just because we're going to turn this into something different where I didn't get to use the experts." Then we made a motion to amend the complaint and then bring in all of the things so that it would help all of the federal motor carriers things and the driver's license things, so it would help frame the issues as to why those experts were important. That was denied. None of that was talked about until we get this bit this morning that 2 weeks before trial, all of a sudden we blindside. No. Then what happens is Levine comes down from Judge Schreier, and Judge Schreier says in Levine that because a layperson does not commonly encounter the truck industry standard of care for the amount of training a truck company should provide to commercial drivers, the port court predicts that the Supreme Court would require plaintiffs to produce expert testimony on the subject. Then we end up going into, that's when we made the motion to amend the complaint a second time. And as a result of that, then here's a signed order from Judge Pekus, where he says, number one, the court, after he's turned us down again, the court recognizes authority from other jurisdictions that the Federal Motor Carrier Safety Regulations does not create a private cause of action for a plaintiff claiming personal injuries resulting from a commercial motor vehicle accident. He then goes on to say the court recognizes Levine as stating that the Federal Motor Carrier Safety Regulations establish the defendant's standard of care. Then we get to trial. We try to put those experts on again. We don't get it. And we get into evidence, and the last witness in the case is the owner who stands up and says, none of those things that plaintiff's been talking about for 3 days matter. Those rules don't really apply. They don't enforce them. And our guys, you know, if he's there on time, he's awake. And you'll see that was well developed in the trial. There's 15 seconds. He didn't know what happened. The driver of this commercial vehicle. I asked him, what did my client do wrong? I don't know. I have nothing. Is there something you think he did wrong? No. What were you doing those 15 seconds while you're making this turn? I don't know. He has no answers until he sees this flashing yellow truck that he knocks the wheels off of.
So Mr. Italo speaks to this in his opinion, and we've discussed it this morning. You know, there's a calculation, whether it's sound or not, as you know, Mr. Arndt argues, I don't know. But in any event, that was proffered at least through his report of some sort of a, you know, 4.5 second or whatever reaction time. I'm trying to figure out why that matters. And I asked a similar question to Mr. Ellis, and it kind of comes back to, if Mr. Duffy has the right-of-way, can he still lose? The reaction time opinion I read from Mr. Italo would apply, perhaps, to a last clear chance theory. That was not in front of the jury. So what does the reaction time really matter if he had the right-of-way?
Because under the federal motor carriers and under the CDL, You are never to make a left turn, ever, if you don't know what's in front of you. And that's a responsibility of the employer, just as it is of the driver, to make sure that they're trained to never make that turn. And by the way, saying that the state has, that our legislature just kind of threw these in, the legislature, as it was said in Levine, they made it a Class 2 misdemeanor to violate these federal statutes.
I think you answered the question, Mr.
Okay.
Clay. Anything else?
My time is out. If there's any question, I appreciate your time.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you. All right. Thank you, counsel, for your arguments. That will conclude the case. We'll be in recess.